Good afternoon to all of you. It's great to be here. Had a cold snap a couple of days ago, and that was quite windy and blustery outside and went to my bones, so that was a little cold. I did appreciate the talent show last week. That was a lot of fun. Of course, Sydney acted up quite a bit, and it's funny here. It's not funny at home. I also appreciated Chad's message. You'll find that it blends quite well with what I'm going to talk about. And then as well, the special music, which they always do a great job. And so I appreciated that, all the work that they put into singing for God and for us to appreciate as well. So thank them. I'm looking for a miracle today. Those are the words that I requested this afternoon when I prayed to God. A miracle. And so I'm looking for a miracle to happen. For some of you, you may have come to services so distraught and so angry with the person that is sitting next to you, your spouse, that you can hardly look at them. That happens. Or it may be something that has been going on for a week or 2 weeks, 3 months, maybe years. And the resentment has built to a climax and you can hardly take it. I think all of us in our marriages, if you've been married for any length of time, I've been married nearly 17 years next week, and many others have been married much longer. But if you've been married for some distance, then there are ups and downs in that marriage. And you will find at times you are upset or angry with your spouse. So this message is for you. This message is for those on the outside of their marriage now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, who will be on the edge of their marriage, on the outer edge, almost ready to say, I quit. I quit. Marriage is probably one of the biggest issues we deal with in the church. And I know there are extenuating circumstances when we talk about marriage and divorce. I'm not here to talk about those extenuating circumstances. I know there are reasons. And as you hear this message, I do not want you to hear condemnation. I know there are members in this audience who have gone through divorce. But again, I want to clearly state, don't hear condemnation. I will simply say the words of Christ and the words of Paul and the words of Moses in an effort to reset our view on marriage, because all too frequently we can have a secular mindset in the church. And divorce and remarriage can happen just as frequently as it does outside of the church. And so that's what I want to do. I want to talk about how Christ views marriage. I want to talk about what we should do. And I want to talk about passing this on to the next generation, our children. And again, I say it one more time. No condemnation in this message. So hear it in that context. Now, when we're first dating, or when you're first married, I recall those wonderful moments of dating and marriage. It is extraordinary It is impressive. It is emotionally high. And you're at work, and all you can think about, for me, was that girl. Or if you're a female, all you could think about is him. Every 15, 20, 30 minutes, it comes to your mind. And it makes for a wonderful time in your life. The emotions are high. But the toils of life and the trials of health and the habits of your spouse bring frustration. And again, all of us who have been married for years understand this. They can bring frustration, sadness, sometimes even anger. You add the kids from babyhood onward, the changing of the diapers, the telling them to brush their teeth, the telling of them to comb their hair, and then they come and you say, no, I told you, comb your hair and brush your teeth. And they come back. This happens all the time for us. Every morning when we're trying to get the kids off for school, no, go again, comb your hair and brush your teeth and get ready. And it's a repetitive cycle. And so that can wear on individuals as you go throughout your day, brush your teeth, comb your hair, go potty, eat your breakfast. Did you finish your homework? It's a rinse and repeat type of job. And I'll say that mothers predominantly bear the burden of looking after the children. I know my wife does the lion's share of the work around the house. I'm generally gone somewhere between 8 to 12 hours a day, and I'm not there. And so she has to do a lot of this by herself. And apart from that, the studies show that women generally do most of the household chores, even if both are working. So you women, you do a lot of work. You have a great load on your shoulders. And again, you share a great deal of the work. It's the hardest job that there is. And you combine this with 8 to 12 hours of working, and as so often is today, both parties working, mother and father, and you have the ingredients for combustion. Throw in lack of sleep, and things can flare up rather quickly. And this occurs even in the best of marriages. And so there's this band. There's the high and there's the low. And on the bottom are frustrations and sadness, anger, annoyances, irritability. You're afraid, you feel disappointed, feelings of helplessness, sheer exhaustion. I know how that feels. And you become overwhelmed and sometimes paralyzed. Some of you have been there. I know that. But if you stay there, if you stay on the bottom, if you stay in that area for a prolonged period of time, if you idle yourself there, your marriage will so decompose. It will so decompose that at best, you will simply be two strangers living together. And at worst, you'll begin to toy. You begin to toy and entertain the idea of what the world calls divorce. If you stay there. And you don't have to stay there. Life becomes so complicated, months and months and years of resentment build, and couples yield to emotional distance in their relationship. And to simply talk with that other party in that relationship is to argue. It's to argue. and nothing seems worse. But on the high side of the gap, we feel completely in love and bonded. And you wake up in the morning and you can hear those birds chirping and the sunshine coming through your glass panes. And then you smell the coffee. She's making coffee for you, eggs and southern style biscuits with white gravy on top of them. And you know it's going to be a really good day. It's going to be a winner. And so you get up and you go into the kitchen and she serves you a nice hot plate, a good cup of coffee or hot tea if you like. And you enjoy a nice conversation with her. And it's lovely. It's lovely. And then you wind up standing up and doing dishes together. Bonded together. Connected in love, secure and happy. Moments of thoughtfulness, of playfulness, of exploration, of discovery. And you feel like you're on top of the world. You feel as if you're on top of the world. And to talk to her or to talk to him, it's simply to communicate affection. That's the high side. That's the high side. And all relationships oscillate between these two extremes. There's a natural ebb and a natural flow somewhere in this band. All relationships experience it. There are moments of romance and moments of delight, moments of sheer ecstasy. But I'm here to tell you, this will not sustain your marriage. It will not. It will not sustain your marriage. What will? What will? How do you and how do I awaken affections that we long thought were dead? How do we do that? What do we do? Well, first, I said we'd talk about Christ's view of marriage. And so let's look at Christ's view of marriage. In Matthew chapter 19, if you turn with me there, if you have your Bibles, let's turn to Matthew 19. Here is a situation where the Pharisees are coming to Christ, and they're coming to trick him. That's what the text says. They're coming to trick him, and Jesus is going to show an exceedingly high view of marriage. A very, very high view of marriage. Now, in verse 3 of chapter 19, it says, the Pharisees also came to him, testing him. So this is a loaded question. This is a loaded question. It's going to offend someone, and they know it. They're testing him. And they say to him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? Well, that's an interesting question. It was a debate that was taking place in that particular day and time. They came to Christ asking what constitutes grounds for divorce. And the daily debate was, for the Jews at the time, if the wife burnt your food, that was grounds for divorce. And so they debated this back and forth. What? Give us a list. Give us a listing of what is applicable to the laws of God. Give us a list as to what constitutes divorce. That's what we want to see. And so they're coming to him, and they're asking for this list. And they say, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason? They were looking for reasons for divorce. Now, what's interesting here is how Jesus responds. They have a category in their mind of enumeration, a listing of reasons for divorce. Now, Jesus is going to give them whiplash. Here's what he says in verse 7. Look at verse 7. They said to him, then why did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? Verse 8, he said, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality, and that's a broad term, that word porneia, it can mean any unlawful sexual intercourse inside or outside of marriage. And in this case, the context is marriage. The context is marriage. That's what their question is. And he says, and he marries another, commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. Now again, what Jesus says here is amazing. Because he ratchets up, he elevates marriage to an extremely high level. And they had no category for this. They had no category for this. He says that even if separated, divorced for non-biblical reasons, the partners are expected to still honor their marriage vows because as far as God is concerned, they're still married. The marriage covenant isn't broken unless, and he gives the example there of adultery. Now, the force of what Jesus says here, the force of his words, they just don't fly over these Pharisees' ears. They understand the force of his words, and so did his disciples. They understand exactly what Jesus is saying, and we know that by their response. So, let's look at what Jesus says. At their shock conclusion. Verse 10. Look at verse 10. His disciples said to him. Now this is his disciples. If such is the case of a man with his wife, it's better not to marry. And again, the Pharisees come to him. And his disciples as well had the same train of thinking. There must be an exit strategy in marriage. Give us a list. Jesus says, I'm not giving you a list. Instead, I'm giving you reasons to stay together. That's amazing. And that's shocking. And again, they had no category for this way of thinking. And so, it's better not to even be married. Who made marriage? Who made marriage? Look at verse 4, chapter 19 and verse 4. Verse 4, and he answered and said to them, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female and said, who said? Who said? God said. God said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then, they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. So it's God who joins people together, husband and wife. It's not the pastor or the priest or the prophet. They are the agents or the means of enacting that process. But they do not do the joining. God does. And so Jesus says, what man or what God has joined together, let no man separate. Now, do you see what's happening here? Again, the categories they had in their mind were, give us a list, show us reasons for divorce. And Jesus says, it wasn't this way from the beginning. It wasn't like this. I'm not giving you a list. What God has joined together, let no man put asunder. That's what I'm telling you. That's radical. That's radical. Now, Jesus is quoting Genesis 1:27 and 2:24, where it says God created them and made them and joined them. Just quickly, because I don't think people read this or see this when they read it. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 22. Notice what it says here. Genesis 2 and verse 22. Well, verse 21. And the Lord caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the rib which the Lord God had taken from the man made he a woman and brought her unto man. Now, did you catch it? He brought her unto Adam. He put Adam to sleep. He took her rib out. He made this woman. And I'm not sure, the text doesn't say. He may have lifted her up and carried her to Adam. He may have held her hand and walked her to Adam. But it says he brought her to Adam. He brought her to Adam. And Adam says, wow, this is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. For she was taken out of man. And therefore, she shall be called woman. Now, that phrase, bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, it resonates throughout the Scriptures. And we're going to see that. Because it's very, very important that we understand that. Very, very important that we understand it. So he brought her to Adam, and you might say that was a wedding ceremony. Now, Paul tells us why marriage was created. Sometimes we look at this and say, well, God formed marriage and then he constructed everything based upon that marriage. That's really backwards. It's backwards. That's not how God did it. So let's look in Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5. This is often read in conjunction with topics of marriage. Very important chapter, the book of Ephesians. And let's look at verse 25. Ephesians 5:25. Husbands. So we're talking to you husbands. Love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. So there's a sacrificial relationship that he's talking about with husbands with their wives, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of the water by the word, that he might present to her, or present her to himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that he should be, or she should be, holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. No one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. Now, this is a very impactful verse. Please, set your eyes on this verse. Very, very critical. Verse 30. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. Remember the account in Genesis. She is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Paul says, for We are members of His body, of His flesh, and of His bones. Verse 31. And for this reason, we are members of His body, of His flesh, and of His bones. And for this reason, what reason? We are members of His body, of His flesh, and of His bones. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. Stunning. Amazing. For this reason, marriage was instituted. Because we are members of His body and of His bones. And that's the reason for marriage. That's the whole reason for marriage. It's a great mystery, he says in verse 32. But I speak concerning Christ and the church. Your marriage, my marriage, marriage as an institution points to Christ and His bride. It points to that union. And so marriage was created to point to the reality. Marriage was created, it's the copy. It's the copy. Christ and His church, that's the reality. Our marriages are a portrait of the reality. They are a picture. They are a banner of the reality of Christ and His church. Again, that's a radical statement. But that's what he says. That's what he says. I wrote a card to Fred and Elsie recently for their 60th anniversary. And on that card I said, marriage is a great mystery. It's called such in Ephesians 5. And you two have been faithful in a 60-year mystery. A 60-year mystery. The first human words recorded were in poetic verse. This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This one shall be called woman, for out of man this one was taken. For 60 years now, your marriage has been pointing to the greatest objective reality, Christ's union with His people. So thank you, Fred. Thank you, Elsie. Thank you both for making all other earthly claims subordinate to your marriage. This is honorable, commendable, praiseworthy, and to be admired. What a breathtaking, awe-inspiring authentication of being bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Such a great mystery, deliberately designed to be so refreshing. And indeed it is. Indeed it is, as it points to Christ and the church. Our marriages put on display the covenant between Christ and His church. Our marriages portray the reality of the love between Christ and His church. Our marriages are a picture of Christ and His church. That's what my marriage represents, and that's what your marriage represents. Our marriages are a shadow of an eternal reality, and we know this. We know this because in Mark, it actually tells us that our marriages cease to exist. That is, when we become spirit beings. They cease to exist. They're good for this lifetime. But in the world to come, in spiritual reality, they cease to exist. But the one union with Christ and His bride, that one's eternal. That union never ceases. that union goes on for eternity. And we'll see that in just a moment. Marriage is a model or a copy of reality. Now, this making of the woman, this didn't catch Christ in this case because he was the creator. It didn't catch him off guard. I mean, he didn't have Adam come out and say, well, Adam, look at all these animals. Well, I don't find anybody that matches my composition. Oh, I made a mistake. God says, I didn't realize that. Let me make a woman. That's not what happened. God doesn't make mistakes. He doesn't make mistakes. Let me read you some scriptural confirmation here. Isaiah 45 and verse 18. Isaiah 45 and verse 18. For thus saith the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who did not create it in vain, who formed it to be what? Inhabited. He formed earth to be inhabited. This is already in God's mind. This isn't something that he just thought of at the spur of the moment. Our booklet, Life's Ultimate Question, Does God Exist? We can read about our destiny, and it says in 2 Timothy 1 verse 9, that was planned before time began. The word there is chronos, like your watch. Before time began, this was already planned. Or Titus 1 verse 2, it says the same thing, before time began. Or Ephesians 1 and verse 4, before the creation of the world. Before the creation of the world. And 1 Peter 1 verse 20. 1 Peter 1 and verse 20. Look at that one. Again, this is, in God's mind, reality already existed. First Peter 1 and verse 20. He was chosen, that is Christ, before the foundation of the world, but was revealed at the end of times for you. So the sacrifice of Christ some 2,000 years ago nearly was planned before the foundation of the world. That is the reality. Your marriage, my marriage, points to that reality. Again, that's stunning. That's stunning. The sense is, the plan was formed and the arrangements were made for the atonement before the world began. Revelation 13. Revelation 13. This is a passage where the beast comes from the sea and one comes from the land. We'll start in verse 7 as this beast coming out of the sea. And it says, it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. It's granted to this beast. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nations. All who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names, notice this, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain. That word slain, it literally means butchered or slaughtered. And notice what it says about this slaughtered lamb, this butchered lamb. It goes on and says, written in the book of the life of the Lamb, slaughtered from the foundation of the world. We see that reality 2,000 years ago, But in God's mind, it had already taken place, you might say, in the plan. In the plan. It was already in his mind how he was going to do this before the foundation of the world. Now, let me give you some physical evidence. So we've seen some scriptural evidence. Let me give you some physical evidence. It didn't catch God off guard. Remember, we said that the one who created Eve says he brought her to Adam. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but did you ever notice that God didn't have to change any biology or structural anatomy of Adam? He didn't have to do that. He could procreate already prior, well, he had to have Eve, of course, but prior to that being a fact, he was created that way. God already knew. In God's mind, he had planned. He had already planned that Adam would have children. And so you look at this parading all these animals before Adam. God already knew. This was just to confirm it in Adam's mind. That's all it did. It confirmed it for Adam. And so that's physical evidence. Again, this didn't catch God off guard. There was no change in Adam's reproductive structure. Now, if this is true, then my marriage and your marriage are not greater than the reality they represent. They are not greater than the reality they represent. Christ and his church, Christ and his union with his church, is greater than our physical marriage. If you followed, if you've tracked with me so far, you've seen that. You've seen that. It's not greater than the reality. Divorce, then, in God's eyes, is detestable, not merely because it involves covenant breaking to one spouse, but because it involves distorting Christ and his covenant. It distorts Christ and his covenant. It distorts the reality. It distorts in others' minds the relationship between Christ and his church, Christ and his bride, because it is to say, when divorce takes place, that my thoughts, my relationship, my thinking, myself, is more important than that. It's more important than Christ and his covenant with his bride. And I don't want to ever say that. I don't want to ever say that. He's much more important. He created all of us. He made all of us. He instituted marriage so that it would reflect upon that. So it would point to that. So we could see that. The reality. But in our society, we so often look at this and forget about that. And this becomes more important than that. Again, may that never be so. May that never be so. Look at Matthew 16, verse 18. Matthew 16, verse 18. Jesus talking to Peter. Matthew 16:18. And Jesus says, in building his church, I also say to you, Peter, on this rock, it's on this small pebble, this small rock or stone, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Now, William Hendrickson says, the Gospel of Matthew states, when Hades is interpreted as indicating hell, the assurance given here by the Lord can be readily understood. Gates of hell represent Satan and his legions, as it were, storming out of hell's gates in order to attack and destroy the church. What we have here is the oft-repeated promise of the victory of Christ's church over the forces of evil. So he's saying the gates of hell, although Satan and all his legions of demons come after the church, and they do in Revelation 12, we read of that, Christ will not leave his church. He will not leave his church. He will let nothing come between he and his bride. Christ will protect and not break covenant with his bride. He'll never leave her, and he'll never forsake her. Never, 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 never will he do so. Now look at Luke chapter 22, as this is very poignant. We often come to this particular topic around Passover. Luke 22. And so frequently read this in the book of John. So Luke chapter 22 and verse 20. Likewise, he, that is Jesus, he also took the cup after supper, saying, Luke 22, verse 20, and you've got to see this with your own eyes. You've got to see this. Luke 22, verse 20. Likewise, he also took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you. Marriage is a display of that. Marriage is a display of that. And so when we come to take the Passover and we take of that bread and that wine, we are talking betrothal. We are talking marriage. We are talking commitment. We are talking unity. We are talking church. We are talking marriage. We are talking reality. Marriage is a display of that. Of that. I hope you remember that on Passover and all that it means. Marriage is a banner designed from the beginning to showcase Christ's covenant-keeping love. And that's why he says, bone of my bones. And that's why he says, flesh of my flesh. And that's why he says, the two shall leave their father and mother and become one. That's why he says it. And yet, that's not the most stunning statement. It goes even further. 1 Corinthians 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Here is the Apostle Paul speaking to the church at Corinth. In chapter 6, let's begin in verse 15. He's saying to them, do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? He said it. Members of Christ. Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Certainly not. Certainly not. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? So he's talking about this one fleshness, this bone of my bones, this being one member. And then he says, for the two, he's quoting Genesis, for the two, he says, who says? God says. For the two, he says, shall become one flesh, but he who is joined to the Lord is one spirit with him. We've gone from bone of my bones to flesh of my flesh to one member to one spirit. That's amazing. The unity of the relationship between Christ and his bride. So now do we see why Jesus Christ didn't give them a list? He gave them reasons to stay together. Reasons to stay together. They were looking for a list, reasons for depart. And he said, let me give you reasons to stay together, because that's how it was designed from the very beginning. It's a miraculous process. Marriage stands as an object lesson for one flesh, for one spiritual union with Christ. Now that we've gone there, and I hope you understand that, it's pretty weighty. After we've gone there, what should we do? What should we do? Well, Paul is going to lay a foundation in Colossians chapter 3. Let's turn there in Colossians chapter 3. For Christ's redemptive work, showing that we are co-buried and co-raised with Christ. And again, this unity, being in Christ, co-buried, co-raised, one bone, one flesh, members of his body, one spirit. And Paul's going to use a metaphor here. It's of putting on clothing. Verse 12. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved. So Paul appeals to a threefold fact here. Elect, called, holy, and loved. And if that's you, listen. Listen to what Paul says. Put on. There's the verb put on. And that verb in the Greek indicates a sense of urgency. So if your marriage is in tatters, this is urgent. This is urgent. Put on. As if you were coming before, or you walked in that door and you had no clothing, you were derobed and you walked in this door, the first thing you would do is run out and get some clothes on. And you would do it urgently. And so Paul says, put on, light clothing, tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering. And then he uses two participial phrases showing how or what we should do. He says, bearing, literally enduring with one another. And then forgiving. That word there means there's no payment that is exacted. There's no payment. Although someone has offended you, although someone does owe you, although someone is guilty, although someone does owe you money, you exact no payment. Forbearing and forgiving. And then he uses another word here. one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, he draws the contrast. Even as Christ forgave you, so you must also do. That's a command. That's not a request. You must also do. But above all things, put on love. Again, the metaphor of clothing. You put on love. You put it on. If a marriage seems dead, you put on love. You put on kindness. You put on mercy. You put on kindness. Someone said love is an action. You put it on. But they don't seem loving. Love them. Love them. You put it on. You do. You do. As I've mentioned before, and it's this text mentions it, even as Christ, so must you also do. And I've talked in the past about this relationship vertically and horizontally. And vertically, I have received forgiveness. I have received justification. I have received sanctification. I have received kindness. And so, having received that from God vertically, I take that and I bend that out to my wife. I bend that kindness. I bend that forgiveness. I bend it out to her. And I bend it out to my kids. And I bend it out to you. And I bend it out to my coworkers. How can I not? How can I not? He's done it for me. And therefore, it says, you must also do. You must also do. But above all things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. Love can be put on, even when you think it's dead. Kindness can be put on, even when you think it's gone. Mercy can be put on, even when they're totally undeserving. And it can be done time after time after time. And those who have been married years upon years upon years, you do not get there by keeping to yourself. You do not get there by not forgiving. You do not get there by being unkind. And you do not get there without love. It's impossible. And so put it on. Put it on. Because I'm called, because I'm holy, because I'm loved, I bend it out to others. I bend it out to my wife. Because of what he's done for me, it blows me away, and therefore I must bend it out. And the degree to which I minimize what he's done for me, the degree to which I minimize the covenant, to that degree is the degree to which my wife pays. When I no longer forgive, when I no longer forbear, when I no longer love, she pays. And any marriage that goes on for any length of time like that will decompose. It will rot from the inside out. Don't Don't let that happen to your marriage. Don't let that happen to the copy that your marriage is of the ultimate reality. Don't let it happen. You fight against that. You look for reasons to stay together. So important. So important what we're talking about today. You bear with, you forgive, and you put on. So what's the secret? How do some couples learn to mend their problems? Well, I'm here to tell you, there are no tricks. There are no gimmicks. There are no sleight of hand tricks that we could come up with for your marriage. There just isn't. The strength, however, of your marriage lies in the strength of your commitment to your marriage. To your marriage. You've made a promise. It lies in that commitment to your promise. And of course, the psalm says, a man swears to his own hurt. And sometimes it's painful. Sometimes it is. But can you imagine Christ saying, they hurt me this time. Well, I'll just put them away. And some say, well, Christ gave a bill of divorcement. And he did. But if you haven't been in the book of Romans lately, go through Romans chapter 9 through 11. And you will see that Christ has not forgotten his covenant. He has not forgotten his covenant with Israel. There's a Bible study that's going on. And I would invite you to please go to that Bible study on Romans. Very, very important book. But Paul says, and he doesn't mean every individual, but he does say all of Israel will be saved. All of Israel. God has not forgotten his covenant. He keeps his word. He keeps his word. The secret to saving your marriage lies in the strength of your commitment to your marriage, which lies in the strength of your commitment to Christ. Your marriage, the strength of that marriage, lies in your commitment to Christ. The more rooted and grounded I am in Christ, the better my marriage will become. And those couples who are successful at reuniting their love are willing to do whatever it takes. Whatever it takes. So that things will work out. They're locked into their relationship. And just like Christ was saying to the Pharisees, there is no exit strategy. There is no exit strategy. And couples that go into this divine union with an exit strategy, as someone said recently, I think it was Gary Petty, who said they're coming very, very, very close to the unpardonable sin. That's frightening. There is no exit strategy when you go into the marriage. And again, as I mentioned at the very beginning, there is no condemnation in what I'm saying. Divorce does take place. I'm not naive to that. But I'm saying the same thing Jesus Christ said. And that is, stay together. Stay together. Don't look for reasons to fall apart. Look for reasons to stay together. There is no exit strategy. You have to want to make it work. And therefore you say to yourself, though the gates of hell come against me and my wife, we will clasp hands together and we will walk forward together. That's what we will do. Because to do less may in fact be saying that my life and my desires and my wishes are more important than Christ's covenantal love to his church. And finally, we have to pass this on to our kids. Our world, our society, says marriage is a throwaway institution. They're redefining marriage as to what it is, what constitutes a marriage. Male and female, male and male, woman and woman. And the list will go on and on as it degrades. We in the church need to have a sound understanding of the value and the worth of marriage. We must. It's the only thing society has to look to gauge what a marriage should be. They have no reference point. We should be that reference point. We should be the reference point, a light on a hill that says this is how a marriage is supposed to be. Passing it on to our kids. Our kids take daily recordings of what marriage looks like, and it will influence and shape their view of marriage. They observe what we're passionate about. So moms, what excites you? What gets you going? What makes you roar? And dads, what excites you? What fills you with excitement? What is so breathtaking and awe-inspiring that moves you? What is it? Our kids, they will find out what we're passionate about. They will find out what the object of our affections are. They will find out. They will know. And if the object of our affections is less than what it should be, they too will emulate those same affections. And again, that's scary. So what is it that you love? What is it that you love? What is it that you're passionate about? I've learned over the years that people, they don't always hear what I say when I'm speaking, and anybody who's spoken realizes that. People don't always hear what you say, but they do understand what you're passionate about. They do understand that. And the same way with our kids. They will understand what you're passionate about. So be passionate about your marriage. Be passionate about Christ and the church. Be passionate about those things. Otherwise, you just leave it up to society to fill the void. And it will be catastrophic. Psalms 145, as we begin to close here. Psalms 145, passing this on to the next generation. This is a wonderful psalm. It's the inscription says, David's song of praise. And notice verse 4 of Psalms 145. If you have time, it would be great to read this entire psalm. It says, one generation shall praise your works to another. One generation shall praise your works to another. Now that's interesting, because we're good, I think, in transmitting knowledge to our children. We can transmit knowledge, head knowledge, understanding. We can transmit that. But this verse says, one generation shall praise your works to another. Why does he say praise? I think it has to do with the affections, the passions. You praise something. You say, God is wonderful. God is great. Look at what he did here. And that fuses with what they already know in their minds. The passions fuse, the affections fuse with the truth that they know. And they become strong young adults and eventually strong Christians. One generation shall praise your works to another and declare your mighty acts. Verse 5, I will meditate on your glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous works. What do you meditate on? Men shall speak of the might of your awesome acts, and I will declare your greatness. You praise this into your kids. You declare this into your kids. You talk to them all the time. Look at what God did for us. Look at what God did for them. Look what God's doing for you. Isn't this wonderful? Isn't this exciting? Because if you don't, and all of us could attest to this year after year after year after year, if you don't, your kids will leave. I've seen it so many times, and it causes me to bleed inside of how many people have left year after year after year because they haven't passed on. They haven't praised God. They haven't passed it on to one generation to the next. They thought the church would do that. That's your job, parents. That's my job. We'd better be about it. We'd better be doing it. What are you passionate about? Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was in Nazi Germany a theologian, in his letters and papers from prison, he says this: as you gave the ring to one another and have now received it a second time from the hand of the pastor, so love comes from you, but marriage from above, from God. As high as God is above man, so high are the sanctity, the rights, and the promise of love. It is not your love that sustains the marriage. Let me read this again. It is not your love that sustains the marriage, but from now on, the marriage that sustains your love. He's saying the promise, the covenant. During the highs and lows and the ebbs and flows, it's the promise you made that sustains your marriage year after year after year. Because the vicissitudes of life, they will bear down upon you. What is your promise worth? Now today I've tried to close the gap between our human view of marriage and Christ's view of marriage. It's a high view, a very high view. And unfortunately, not everybody here will get it. I know that. In fact, if you look in Matthew 19 again, notice what Christ says in Matthew 19. In verse 11. But he said to them, all cannot accept this saying, but only those to whom it has been given. He who is able to accept it, let him accept it. Divorce is a human institution. Marriage is a divine institution. That's a fact.